This is Fred Wildenberg. A big issue for humanity is the spiritual divides that exist. Within these divides, some are entrenched in their place. Many seem indifferent to divisions. Others embrace the plurality of differences. And in this podcast, Peace Within Reach, I discuss with people why they stand where they do. I don't believe we're hopelessly divided. My guest again today is Robert Cordes. And Robert and I have been friends for about 3 years, and I've just really enjoyed our friendship. He's really stretched me, I would say, in my reading materials and learning about science, evolution, different perspectives on the origin of the world, which has been helpful to me. And just interested in each other's lives and each other's families has been really great. So, yeah, Robert's here with me today. I want to touch on just briefly last time, Robert focused on two areas. I should back up. Robert's focused mostly on his spiritual journey from being a believer in God to presently being, as Robert described, a naturalist and a humanist who is no longer a believer in God. But today, Robert, we're going to focus on two areas. Maybe the first 10 minutes or so, highlighting briefly what I heard you explain as issues you had with the Bible and with the church, which in part led you away from faith in God. And then I like to give my rationales for why the Bible and church are like that. I hope I'm not too defensive on that, because I probably shouldn't be. And then we can discuss and you can challenge those a bit further. And then the second part, and actually this will be more of our time, I'd like to get more into evidence, the word evidence compared to arguments. Excuse me. We'll call it our apologetic part of our discussion today. And so, Robert, I want to highlight some of the issues that I heard you say last week. And correct me if I'm wrong or if I miss anything, but it seemed to be, you know, what you mentioned, seeming contradictions in the Bible and harshness of the Old Testament. As well as many in the church's seeming disdain of LGBTQ and maybe perhaps, you know, conservative view or perhaps disdain of those who've had abortions, some of the church focus on money, as it seems, and you also mentioned Jesus smuggling into arguments, kind of a frustration. Robert, regarding contradictions in the Bible and harshness of the Old Testament, I'm going to say harshness of the Old Testament. I give my reason for it, but I'm not going to defend it. It is what it is, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say Book of Judges, you know, some of the Book of Joshua when the Israelites were going from the Exodus out of Egypt into the land of Canaan, there was a lot of war. And oftentimes God's people were the victors, and there was a lot of bloodshed on the enemies. And I really think a lot of it was God trying to keep his people focused on worshiping him and not some of the other gods that, you know, they were finding along the way that the other people who were really called the heathens were worshiping. And I do find in many places in the Old Testament a love of God for people beyond Israel, you know, beyond the Israelites, you know, and a desire that, you know, all people come to know him. But there were certain periods of time, I must admit, that, you know, it's harsh. It really is, you know, Book of Joshua and Judges especially, some of the laws in Leviticus are, you know, again, a lot of that was, I think, trying to get his people to have a tight-knit relationship with him and not be so influenced in that critical time of the nation building. You have any thought on that back, or you want to concur that that's...
Well, I think that's a pretty, I'd say, a better view of the Old Testament than some others I've heard, which a lot of people go to great lengths to try and to defend. Mm-hmm. The actions of the people of, you know, the Israel during the Old Testament.
Okay.
If the Old Testament read as simply a historical narrative of this is the history of our people, good and bad, mm-hmm. Then I wouldn't really take issue with it. But the fact that I read the Old Testament and I see people trying to very much justify their actions by saying, well, God commanded us to do this horrific thing. Mm-hmm. Really, it was just human beings being tribalistic, warring human beings. You know, it was a brutal time, likely for the whole world at that time. You know, the Bronze Age was a pretty, you know, particularly brutal time in history.
And including the enemies of God's people against the people of God.
I mean, you know, obviously the Old Testament only focuses on a very narrow region of the world, but if you study history, you'll see that a lot of the really atrocious things we see in the, you know, Old Testament were happening all over the world. So I think the nation of Israel was very much a product of their time in that regard. But what I don't see is them acting any better than the people around them. They were no more, you know, righteous or holy or more merciful than many of the, you know, tribes that they went to war against. And you would expect that them to be, you know, God's chosen people, that they would maybe act in a little bit better of a way, but you don't see that at all. You see pure human nature coming through in their acts of war and their acts of genocide and rape and slavery and so on. And you would hope that people that were getting, you know, revelation directly from God, that some of those things would be abolished. You know, we in modern times have outlawed many of these things, you know, and made a lot of them into war crimes and whatnot. But at that time, it was considered completely acceptable. And I would expect that if they truly were God's people and had access to God directly, that if we consider those things to be bad nowadays, why didn't God impart on these people they were bad back then? To me, things like not raping people, not taking people as slaves should be a pretty timeless thing if we truly consider it to be a bad thing. But what I see is Israel very much just being simply a product of their time and place.
Yeah. I don't know which examples you mean by where there was rape. I know there was rape, but that specific sin, and I would define sin as anything contrary to God's will, that specific sin, you know, that was punished, I believe, if not by God, by, you know, directly by those who were the loved ones of those who were offended. But hey, I can't defend too much of that. I realize there's some tough history there. You know, sometimes we talk about war, you know, as being justified, I think some would defend a lot of those as justified wars, you know, and sadly we hear the military term. I wouldn't say it's improper, it's perhaps correct, but it's difficult and harsh, is collateral damage. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of innocents caught, and so let's move on. But it's tough, isn't it? It really is. And and then seeming contradictions in the Bible. I think let's just go right to the New Testament. So we did get different accounts of the Gospels, perhaps the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I have not seen many contradictions beyond different accounts of perhaps Jesus' life, a little bit of different nuances maybe on teachings. You know, one highlights more of a certain part of a story or an event than another does, but I haven't personally seen read a lot of contradictions. Can you think of any that come to your mind right off the bat?
I know there's a professor of New Testament history named Bart Ehrman, and I know an exercise that he does to his students when they come in and take one of his classes, they tell them to go through the Gospels and start with Jesus being put on trial. Start there and go all the way to the end of the book and map out all the events that happen and lay them side by side.
The end of the book being into Revelation?
No,
the end of the Gospel.
Okay. End of Gospel. Mm-hmm. So the end of the story, basically.
Okay.
From Jesus from going on trial to his trial to his crucifixion to his resurrection, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And lay out all the kind of pertinent details of that story and see how they line up. And when you do that, you find that all four Gospels contradict each other in many, many different ways. Some small, maybe benign, for example. But if you were to go, so say that, you know, we were in a court and somebody was on trial, and you brought up four different witnesses, and all four witnesses told a different story, it would not lend a lot of credibility to the story. Maybe they all have similarities, maybe their stories overlap in some way, but if they're missing very key details of the story, that really calls into question the validity of that story.
Okay.
I would say that would be one example. And then you also see, and it's not, I think people tend to overlook it, but Paul in particular had a lot of issues with Jesus' disciples and their teachings, and was very open about the fact that he was very much at odds with these people and a lot of the teachings. And if you go into that, it's pretty well recorded in there that they had a lot of disagreements on that, which between any individuals as men, you're going to have disagreements. But then it makes it very hard to paint a solid picture of what the Bible actually is trying to convey when the people writing in the Bible seem to have different ideas as to that. So I have a real issue when people say, well, the Bible clearly says. Well, probably not. I'm sure, for every verse that you could point out that, fits your side, I can find a verse somewhere else that fits another side. A good example is how are people saved? Is it through faith or works? You can find verses in the New Testament that support both cases. So
actually, I'm going to say we're not saved by faith or works. We're saved by God's grace through faith. But we'll save that for another discussion because that gets into that whole theology.
We can get into the weeds of that one another time maybe, but just throwing it out there as an example.
I appreciate that. Some of this may be, I'm a believer in God, in Jesus as my Lord and Savior. So, I read with excitement or interest, like the end of the Gospels, from Jesus' death until his ascension. And I just don't see those, I don't look for those, perhaps those contradictions in the narratives. But I may give, credit rather than challenge, though. I find the different details interesting. I don't like line them up and to find the holes in it. And I'm going to say that's, as a person of faith, I don't look for those. And perhaps maybe someone with, from your perspective, would more. And I don't mean that bad. I kind of appreciate that. Because I'll say, ultimately, it does come down to faith. I have to have faith, so I'll read the different accounts or even Paul and the disciples and who became apostles like Paul. And sometimes there are differences with each other. And I would say, well, they were just men, and I'll find an amazement in the Bible that, wow, all these mere humans wrote this whole book and somehow it gels amazingly well. I mean, the unity of it is pretty amazing considering the, probably 4,000 years plus of history within that book. But again, I'm going to see that from my perspective a bit different from you.
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly never would have looked at these things either until I started having doubts and started taking into question. I think a big point too is that if you were to look at a lot of these stories in the Bible and look at them purely as, okay, this is a story meant to convey a message, then it makes sense that you're going to have people trying to tell that story their own way. I think the Gospels are a perfect example of four different people telling the story four different, very different ways and having emphasis, as you said, on different parts of that story. The trouble comes in, and I don't have any issue with that. The trouble comes in when you try to say that this is literal history. If it's going to be literal history, then we need to be very careful about our facts on that. If we're going to tell a literal history of a war that went on, we need to at least know which side won the war. It'd be good to know, who struck first. It'd be good to know how many people were lost from each side. It'd be good to know any details about that war that were unique. But we need to come to some sort of agreement on that if we're going to present that war as a historical narrative. And where the issue comes in is when people try conveying the resurrection of Jesus as a historical narrative, and the facts are simply not adding up or contradicting each other. Then it calls into question the historical validity of that story. It doesn't necessarily mean that this isn't a story that's trying to convey a message. That's, I have no issue with looking at the Bible as a whole in that mm-hmm. very same way. Just as you said, you can take the Bible, and if you take a very, you know, I'll say Google Earth view of it, where you really zoom out, you're right. You can find a lot of common threads throughout the Bible, just as you can for a lot of other great works of, you know, from that time period. Mm-hmm. So it's, I guess it's okay. all on how you want to view the Bible through right. what, through what lens.
Yeah, I think we're going to move on, and I'm going to, that was, I think that was a good explanation there. I want to just kind of touch, and I want to be a little briefer on this because we're already a little ways into it, and I'd like to get to my next subject. But, you know, regarding, I appreciated last time, Robert, you mentioned concern for outcasts. You mm-hmm. I think you used that term, and you had that concern really from a childhood on. I thought yep. that was actually really a wonderful thing about you. Regarding, you know, the seeming disdain of the church toward LGBTQ and also maybe too many an annoying view, a conservative view on against abortion, which is annoying to some people, you know, that view. Well, I'm going to try and be brief on it, but regarding LGBTQ, the concern of a lot of conservative Christians is, you know, we believe God made the family this way, you know, a man and a woman, you know, they have children together, they get married and they have children together. And that's just the way that it always seemed to, that's the way the Bible has always lifted it. And, you know, oftentimes these, by the grace of God, these families do very well. At times they don't either. But, and so, you know, I'd like to say to the benefit of, you know, to the benefit, the giving, I guess, benefit it out for church would be the conservative view, you know, that, wow, our society, when we, you know, start to advocate same-sex marriage and things like that, they feel like it's a breakdown of the family, you know, as God made it. And therefore, that being a harm to, you know, a potential harm to everyone, you know, and so that's the concern. I realize it seems harsh, but and the Bible would teach, and I hope churches teach, that we are to love, well, the cliche, love the sinner but hate the sin. And that's for many things. That's for things I do, things, you know, whoever does, that are things contrary to God's will. But yes, many would put, things that are what seem to be contrary to the family as God ordained it to be sin. Again, you love that person, and if the church, and the church doesn't do this well, I agree with you there. You know, they have not loved the sinner and tried to help through the sin. You know, regarding abortion, the whole perspective, I mean, they're taking the place that this is a little human life, you know, that, and that they would say, you know, whereas the far left side would say that's a fetus, you know, they wouldn't even want to describe it as a baby until it's breathing oxygen, you know, the air actually. And, you know, I think conservative Christians are concerned about, wow, this is human life, you know, and to terminate that, you know, they call that killing that, you know. We're going to have different perspectives on that all day long, but that I just wanted to kind of, you know, highlight, you know, why the church does what they do sometimes, unfortunately poorly, because in sin we aren't loving as much as we can be disdaining. And that's a sad thing, I must admit. Do you want to speak to that a moment?
Yeah. Well, you and I could probably do a whole one of these podcasts yeah. just on the topic of abortion. Obviously I have different disagreements about the church's view on both abortion mm-hmm. and the issue of LGBTQ. But I think what it really boils down to is something that I mentioned in the last thing, was that rather than, I wouldn't have much of an issue if the church chose to say, this is our view that we're holding as a church, but the world's free to do what they want. The mm-hmm. problem is when the church, as we've seen tremendously in the last several decades, mm-hmm. but particularly in the last few years, the church has wanted to make it a political thing and wanted to try and force their views on the country at large,
right?
Even though they make up, talking specifically about evangelical Christians, make up a very small minority of this country, mm-hmm. they want to push their view and expect everybody else to live according to their view. And that's when I kind of bring out, my battle armament, and I'm going to fight you for it. Mm-hmm. Because if you as a church decide that this is how you want to live in the world, mm-hmm. I respect your right to do so, and I'm not mm-hmm. going to impede on that right. Mm-hmm. I'd like to convince people that they're wrong in those views,
right.
But I would in no way expect other people to live that way. Yeah. Nobody is going into a church and telling pastors they have to marry gay people. It just, I know that's a big...
Oh, they're getting close, though.
I don't think they're getting close at all, to be honest. I mean, we've seen cases of, the famous cake baker, being, the whole wanting to bake a cake, and they're winning in court. I mean, these people are not being forced to do things that are against their religion. And so I know it's a fear that's drummed up by people in politics, mm-hmm. but it's just not happening. But what you are seeing is the other side of it, where the mm-hmm. people are saying, well, my religion dictates this position, and so the rest of the country has to abide by that. And that's where I take issue.
Yeah.
I'm all about personal freedom. I'm mm-hmm. all about religious institutions being able to practice their beliefs. But when those beliefs spill out into the streets and affect my life and other people's, That's more where I take an issue with it. So,
And theologically, the kind of the reason, Robert, and I know you know this, but just for the listeners, is God tells us in the Bible, tells believers to make disciples of all nations, baptizing in the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and kind of what that means is go out and spread the good news of freedom from sin and And so, believers are told to, help God change the world. And then that can sound very political. So I think that's always going to be an issue, mm-hmm. for the church, because they're seeking truly to follow what God calls them to do. I'm gonna close this part of it just saying, this is a quote that I use in my book, A Search for Common Ground, Let's Talk. But and it came from Rick Warren's book, and he says there, his book, Purpose Driven Life, every church could put out a sign, and this is what the sign would say: no perfect people need apply. This is a place only for those who admit they are sinners, need grace, and want to grow. And the church is full of people like me, who make lots of mistakes, who perhaps want to love people who are far different from me, even including our moral perspectives, our understandings, and yet I don't always do that so well because I'm so human in need of God's grace. Hey, Robert, let's shift, though. Last time you said science has been your North Star, and I imagine you would agree with Jerry Coyne in his book, I hope I said that right, Why Evolution is True. When he writes, evolution is a theory, just like the theory of gravity, but it's a theory that is also a fact. And he goes on to explain how evidence is found mostly in the fossil record. And Robert, I found his book to be helpful. That's the book you suggested I read. And so I appreciate you suggesting it. I'm open-minded to Jerry Coyne's statements and his explanation, but as an admitted atheistic evolutionist, as Coyne is, he doesn't see God as part of the equation, and this is unlike his science colleague Francis Collins, who is a God-believing evolutionist. And he wrote the book you also suggested I read, which I really like too. The book is called The Language of God, in that he describes what he believes can be a harmony between science and faith in God. And so I asked you, Robert, we touched on it a little bit last time, help define, in your view, what is acceptable evidence, especially in the way of science. I think you said something like putting it through the test of being able to be falsified. And then maybe take just a moment to compare evidence to a good argument that is not necessarily evidence. And then we'll kind of get into some of the different arguments I like to raise and mm-hmm. get your thoughts on them.
Sure, yeah. Well, lots to unpack there.
Okay.
Yeah, regarding Jerry Cohen, I don't know if you would say mostly fossil record. That's certainly one part of the puzzle, but it goes much beyond that.
Okay.
Francis Collin, of course, talks about DNA and how mm-hmm. the evidence for that. And we also have, you know, the geological record. You know, there's also things in cosmology that we look at
mm-hmm.
that. Not so much. Cosmology just states more the evidence for how old the universe is, but it's not directly tied to evolution. I just want to correct that there.
Mm-hmm.
In regard to Francis Collin, what's really interesting about his book is and it's a really great book. It's one that if anybody mm-hmm. wants to dive into, from a Christian perspective, wants to dive into evolution, it's the one I think people should start with.
And what is that called again?
The Language of God,
okay.
from Francis Collin. But if you notice that he doesn't necessarily try to provide any actual evidence for God in the book. His book is definitely, you know, I went through with a fine tooth comb just to make sure he wasn't Jesus smuggling, and he doesn't, and I give him a lot of credit for that. I mean, he very much comes to it from the point where this is my faith, and I don't find, it's not a contradiction between me and the science that I do. But he's the first one to tell you that when a scientist goes into the lab and puts on that lab coat, he leaves God at the door. God is not allowed into that lab because he can never qualify as an explanation for any of the science that they do. And any good scientist will tell you that, whether they're Christian or otherwise. And that's why I respect Francis Collins as I do, is because he does science right. He's not trying to Jesus smuggle anything.
I'm just going to take...
He's such a reputable scientist. I mean,
right.
he's kind of undeniable. I mean, if anybody, you know, looks up Francis Collins on Wikipedia, the man's credentials are unmistakable.
I think he's a geneticist, a physician, and I think he's also, or has been, the director of the National Institute of Health.
Yes,
yeah.
yes, among many other
right.
things, you know. And he's, you know, his team is responsible for mapping out the mm-hmm. human genome mm-hmm. of DNA. So, but, you know, that's just kind of a little bit of a side mm-hmm. note.
Yeah.
But in regards to science and what constitutes evidence, it's just, it's something, you know, to get to, you know, evolution, you know, the Jerry Cohen quote you said about evolution as a theory,
mm-hmm.
You know, the word theory in the colloquial sense of the word versus the scientific use of the word is a very different thing, and people oftentimes make that mistake. Things that are considered a scientific theory, in that sense, theory is considered a well-substantiated explanation for something that's based on a body of facts that have been repeatedly confirmed through observation and experiment.
Okay.
And, you know, and as he says, you know, the theory of gravity is a good example of that. And evolution, as you know, Jerry points out in his book, Why Evolution is True, I mean, the evidence for evolution is just as strong, if not more so, than we have for the theory of gravity. And to get to your question about evidence, it's just something, you know, is observable, testable, can be replicated, and be falsifiable. Falsifiable is part of the whole.
What do you mean by that? Can be falsifiable? Can
that means to me, there needs to be a way that we can prove this wrong. So if I come up with a hypothesis
okay.
that all swans are white, all I need to do is find one swan that's not white, and my hypothesis falls apart.
Okay.
And so just like with any other scientific theory, theory of gravity, if I was to drop this pop can and it all of a sudden started floating on its own, that's going to call into question the theory of gravity, and the scientists are going to have to go back to their drawing boards and maybe fix some things on their theory. Same with evolution. Okay. If we suddenly, you know, we're looking at the fossil records and all of a sudden we found a bunny rabbit in between a couple of prehistoric dinosaurs, that's going to call into question this theory mm-hmm. of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So far, that has never happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it's leaving that door open to the possibility that we could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the absolute foundations of science. It's just, we always need to leave open that door to the possibility that some other evidence could come down the road, and we're going to need to change our view on things. And this has happened all throughout scientific history. And thankfully, it has. I mean, if you look, say, at the medical field, there's a lot of very barbaric practices that people did even 50, 60 years ago that were pretty widely considered the medical standard. And now we've since gotten more evidence, so we've learned better, and so now we don't have people sticking needles into your head and scrambling your brain to try and fix mental disorders.
In a sense, they were falsifiable.
They were
shown that there's better ways.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
You know, I think that's... did you want to say any more on that? Or I think that's a kind of a good way to compare the two,
mm-hmm.
you know?
And we can get to your second question about arguments. I think there's nothing wrong with arguments. I mean, the whole what do you want to say, the whole field of philosophy is about great arguments, mm-hmm. and it's really fun, and you know, I enjoyed philosophy when I was in college, mm-hmm. but having a good philosophically sound argument is not the same as evidence. If you've ever served on a jury, one of the first things they will tell you is the opening closing statements cannot be brought as evidence, because it is not evidence. It's just the lawyers making really good arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important to do. That's a really important point, because you can make really good arguments about any number of things. I've heard convincing arguments for the existence of Bigfoot and the Yeti. I've heard, you know, documentaries that lay out how aliens were the ones that built the pyramids, because we have no other explanations. I know of many people who are convinced that, you know, Adolf Hitler escaped Berlin at the end of World War II and is living somewhere in South America. So you can have a really fun, convincing argument that seems to hold up as far in terms of plausibility.
Mm-hmm.
But just like with, you know, Bigfoot, the pyramids, and Hitler, we need actual sound evidence of these things in order then to be considered a belief worth holding on to, I'll say.
So I find that really interesting. I like the analogy of the kind of the jury, you know, the opening and closing statements. Now, you and I know that there have been many people on trial who, you know, there just hasn't been able to be found clear evidence on if they did it or if they didn't do it,
whatever
they're being charged with. And yet, you know, they either did it or they did not.
Yep.
And some have, you know, gone to prison improperly, you know, because one lawyer had the better arguments than the other, and how unfortunate that is.
Yeah.
But and so I, you know, there's just so many cases where there's not going to be able to be hard evidence, but probably plenty of good arguments, and plenty of times a person went to prison without having hard evidence being found, but they actually did it and they got convicted, and there were just enough strong arguments and they justly went to prison. So a lot of just things are very hard to prove,
one way or the other.
I guess, beyond a reasonable doubt, sure. Right? That's the words they use.
No, and that brings up a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I guess one of the philosophies that I have is that we don't have to always have all the answers. We don't have to know 100% one way or the other. In fact, you probably shouldn't know 100%. You should always be open to the possibility that you're wrong. But you're exactly right. There's a lot of things that we maybe just simply can't know for certain one way or the other. And then it just becomes down to either just leaving it, if you were to fill it out on a paper, whether you believe on that, you just leave it blank. Just put a question mark in that point. There's no sense in needing to come down strongly one way or the other, or you can look at it from the sense of, you know, I tend to lean this way or the other,
right.
You know, maybe if you want to set a percentage point on it, you know, I'm 20% sure that this is correct, but, you know, I could be wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that I found very useful for adapting more of a scientific mindset, is being able to, A, not have to have hard, solid answers for everything, and B, being able to admit when I'm wrong if I come across other evidence.
So let me bring up a few, what I would say I feel are arguments for my faith in God.
Okay.
And then what I'll say is, you know, this has led me to, I will admit that even before I've delved more into these arguments and have written about them in my book, you know, there's a lot that weighs on either believing in God or not, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there comes a point for many where they're not just okay with what do you believe in and put question mark forever, but they finally say, well, there's enough arguments for it, you know, not necessarily hard evidence, but arguments that, you know, push me toward belief. And there's profound, I guess there's, you know, there's much to believing. There's the whole question of eternity, of forgiveness of sin, all those things. And so, and that's why they ultimately go to belief. But I'm going to just say, like, I'm going to highlight some, you know, that help me in my belief. You know, the philosophy of spiritualism, I kind of write about that in my book, but just that there's not just the physical or the emotional, but there's also the spiritual. I like to discuss just even areas such as Ouija boards, you know, things that I would tend to leave alone. I think people would say seems to be real power in perhaps psychics and mediums and shamans and, you know, and medicine men. You know, people would say, well, there's plenty of fakes. And yes, I'll bet you there are plenty of fakes, but I believe there's probably enough evidence that there's been some real ones as well. So just the whole thing of spirituality, there's something out there, and God being spirit, the spirit that I, you know, give my allegiance to, you know, again, I can see people doubting spirituality, but you're really going to throw all those things out, you know? Oh, I like to go to talk about a little bit spiritual gifts. You know, I think we all have different spiritual gifts and abilities, special abilities. I'll just say special abilities. I have a daughter. My one daughter is very artistic. Can draw very nice pictures. Can paint beautifully. And she has a dad, myself, who you know, I can't draw very well at all. You know, and my wife can a little bit, but somehow she got that. We have these different kinds of abilities, different kinds of intelligence. You know. That are pretty amazing. In the Bible, a lot of times the abilities, when a person is a believer, we call them spiritual gifts. But I did highlight last time the spiritual gift of tongues. You know, the speaking in tongues. I was in a prayer circle not long ago, recent. You know, and sincere believers. I mean, I've known these guys for a long time, and what a unique thing, speaking in tongues. We were in a prayer circle and they're praying in tongues around me. There was no one in that setting who were then interpreting, you know, another spiritual gift that's highlighted in the Bible, especially in 1 Corinthians 12. But I've been in a setting there too where someone was then interpreting what the other person was speaking in tongues. You know, I know there's going to be naysayers saying, you know, skeptics saying, oh, that's all fake. All of it? You know, I just think that's so easy for people to do. You know, miracles and just, and I'm one who has not experienced not a lot of miracles in my life. I wish I experienced more, where I think it's an absolute miracle. I define as what has to be really a supernatural act, and I'm going to attribute that to God. I do have a couple of friends who, you know, they seem to, I wouldn't call that be a gift, but, you know, have experienced firsthand, you know, miracles following prayer. Some would say, ah, that's fake. And I guess I'd have to say, really, all of it? You know, I'll stop there, Robert. Maybe I'll bring up another thing in a little bit. But,
sure.
You know, can there be enough good arguments that can finally push into person to say, you know what, there's not maybe not hard evidence of that, but there's so many arguments that, yeah, I can see how those people come to believe, you know, rather than just always write that question mark, which, yeah, you want to speak to that a little bit?
I guess, yeah, you kind of went through a lot there.
So I did.
We'll come full circle back, okay, back to your original point. Can there all be right enough good arguments? I'd say for something that you're going to commit your entire life to, mm-hmm, no, there can't be enough good arguments. If it's something you want to dabble in or have an interest in, I'd say you knock yourself out. I mean, I'm, you know, I'm definitely leaning on the existence of Bigfoot. I definitely think there's a good, being from the Northwest myself and knowing how dense those woods are, I think there's a chance that there could be some big bipedal animal out there that we're not we don't know of.
Okay.
And I love entertaining the idea, but I'm not going to put any sort of time or money or effort into this idea. It's just something that's fun. And what the problem that I have is when most people are a part of a religion, they're all in, and they devote tremendous amounts of their own personal time, mm-hmm. their money, their efforts into this thing. And to me, if you're going to make that type of commitment, you should be very sure. And so I, in my opinion, no, there's not enough good arguments for somebody to go whole hog into a religion. And,
okay.
and as far as I'm concerned, obviously other people think differently, but I'm just not one who's, I'm just very skeptical about nature, and I'm not one who's very easily swayed by merely an argument, mm-hmm. because I can probably come up with a...
No matter how many arguments there might be.
No. Because, like I said, an argument isn't evidence. If you have evidence to back up your arguments, then we have something to look at. Then we can talk. Then we can start to compose something. You know, an argument should lead you to pursue evidence that supports that. And what I see often in the case of religion is there's a lot of arguments, and they stop there, and nobody's bothering to actually look for evidence to support that argument. And what generally happens is skeptics and the scientists come out and be like, well, actually, no, here's what's wrong with your argument, and here's the scientific evidence that shows why it's wrong. And that's you know, what I see happen very, very, it'd be a very common thing, you know. And in regards to, you know, that you talk about spirituality, I guess we should maybe figure out how you define spirituality. I mean, if mm-hmm. if we're talking about something maybe beyond ourselves, something a little existential, I could be okay with that. If we're going to get into the realm of supernatural, then, you know, it's just something I just don't see any evidence for, personally.
Yeah. You know, the definition I used in the book, and I got this from somewhere else, the philosophy of spiritualism is the belief that there is an immaterial reality that cannot be perceived by the senses, and that spirit exists as distinct from matter. So, you know, that would be the definition of spirituality there. And I would say it, you know, I would see spirituality as something beyond material, beyond emotion, not just something that someone has, you know, drawn up that makes them feel good. You know, I'm going to say there's something actually there. But yeah, you know, and again, I'm going to say I feel like there's arguments for that. But, you know, can I give hard evidence? Well, I guess, would you be one to believe that that some of the medicine men, some of the psychics, mediums, shamans, do they have, is there real power there, would you say? Is any of those, Robert?
No, I mean, not in,
okay.
not
so
in the
you
supernatural,
actually would...
not in the supernatural sense. I
okay.
think they have, that's not to say they don't have, they're not very gifted in what they do. I think there's a lot of people who have amazing ability. I mean, let's give the example of somebody who's a really good public speaker,
mm-hmm.
somebody who's able to just draw on a crowd and have them hanging on every word, and is able to just control a whole
right.
crowd. I mean, you see this with musicians, with public speakers, with religious leaders, with politicians. You see
mm-hmm.
that? That's an incredible gift, but there's
okay.
nothing supernatural about it. They're just really good at what they do. And I think the same
right.
thing with shamans and mm-hmm. whatnot. And I think what they're doing is they're tapping into very, you know, emotions and cues that we have as humans that we maybe aren't aware of. I mean, there's been many, many examples of, let's say, psychics or mediums or magicians
mm-hmm.
who, you know, are able to demonstrate how they do these things, how they're able to supposedly read people's minds or to get people to do crazy things under hypnosis. And it seemed to the layperson, it may seem like there's some sort of supernatural thing going on, but as has been demonstrated many times over, it's just people have a certain gift and are really good at manipulating other people.
Okay.
And so that's not to say necessarily that all these, you know, things like speaking in tongues, that people are intentionally being deceitful. It's just that there's something going on mentally that maybe they're not even aware of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you know, I think we'll agree to disagree on that. That's good. That's fine. You know, I guess what I and we should close this up pretty quick. I haven't even gone into the Bible, you know, the historicity of the Bible, and you know, but I know you. I would say there's a lot of what I would believe is accuracy of the Bible compared to some of the secular writings, but I know we've had good discussion and debate, and you might beat me on that discussion because I know you read on as well, and that'll have to be for a different time.
Sure.
I really appreciate you being here on this subject. We just run out of time quickly because we're already at 45 minutes and we can go longer.
You start making these long 3-4 hour debates. That'd be fun.
Okay. You know, I'm going to say again, I think belief, you know, people, I think a lot of times will hold out on trying God because it, you know, so many of these arguments don't fit into what I would say is their narrow allowance, of what is, you know, what is, evidence that they can go with, you know, and, yeah, you know, I can respect that. I will be one as a pastor to say, you know, because I've experienced God, and I feel the warmth from that relationship with God. But I don't want it to be blind faith either, right? Where I just go forward with what makes me have a warm, fuzzy feeling inside, and that's partly why I've kind of gone to wanting to read more on science and finding ways to harmonize science. And, you know, I believe I'm okay with some of those science, the evolution and the Big Bang, personally believing God is behind it. And some of what I had to do is the arguments I've had to look into spirituality more, think about the spiritual gifts, you know, things like that, studying the Bible and being able to say, yeah, okay, that backs up my faith more, but I don't think I'm going to talk other people into that in that way, and I'm okay with that. You know, I would challenge people to not just always put question mark there, but finally say, well, perhaps, maybe as the psalmist says, at least I can taste and see, you know, that the Lord is good. Do little taste. You don't have to go for the whole meal, but, you know, try something and follow the arguments a bit, and maybe finally there will compile enough to say, okay, I maybe want to take another bite, perhaps. But Robert, a pleasure again, and I hope I didn't run this conversation too much and talk it too much, but maybe we'll have another opportunity for this, okay?
I hope so. It's always fun.
It is. Thanks.
Father, thank you for creating each person in your image, designing them in your likeness with an ability to be in relationship with you and with each other. Thank you for giving us an ability to think and to rationalize and to have different brains, some being very analytical, others creative, some being perhaps more social, and that we can have friendships though and learn from each other. As Robert and I discussed today and the last time we talked, ultimately it comes down to having faith in you. And for many, that's, at this moment, seems to be impossible to them. And so, as Robert said at our meeting last time, perhaps it takes a miracle from you, an absolute supernatural act, perhaps a where an arm is off of a person and an arm has been lost and you put an arm back on that person. You are supernatural and do your work however you need to be a presence in a person's life. So that be my prayer for each and every person made in your image, again, made wired in a sense and designed to know you. And Jesus, thank you for your love, and which especially was shown in your death on the cross, which and your conquering death, which bridged the way to the family of God. So Jesus, we pray in and through your name this day. Amen.